Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Sarah Bankson, and I'm Deputy Director of RTP. Today, we are delighted to host two stellar experts to discuss public labor unions and release time. We're joined by Jonathan Ridges, Director of National Litigation at the Goldwater Institute, and James Shirk, Director of the Center for American Freedom at America First Policy Institute. Thank you both for being with us today. Our listeners can read the full and impressive bios for both of our speakers at regproject.org. With that, I'll hand it over to you, James.
Thank you, Sarah. John, we might start this session by just asking a more fundamental question is, what are government unions and why do they exist? You know, historically, unions were only the private sector. The idea was that you had businesses which had a profit motive, obviously, to make as much profit as they could, and that would include holding down wages. And so you'd have unions to sort of counterbalance the business power and help the workers get a share of the profits their labor's helped create. But the government doesn't have profits. And for a very long time, you had leaders in the union movement and in the progressive movement. Samuel Gompers was famously opposed to the idea of unionizing government. George Meany, the first president of the combined AFL-CIO, said bargaining collectively is impossible in government. He said that in the 1950s. FDR, very famously, he was the one who signed the National Labor Relations Act that gave the private sector unions a ton of power. But he very famously said, well, of course you can't do any of this in the government. The government has a special duty to the public trust. But now we've got about half of the union movement is in the government. And could you tell the listeners just what these unions are exactly doing in the government and why they're there?
Yeah, well, to the best I can. Here's the problem, I think. I think when most people think about labor unions, they think, as you mentioned, James, about labor collectively organizing for a higher piece of wages that they helped, you know, create. That's nothing like that in the government sector. And you have some real public policy concerns that exist with government labor unions that don't exist with private unions. So the first, I think, real fundamental constitutional problem is this transfer of democratic authority from elected officials to unelected union bosses. When you think about the collective bargaining process, you have a union leader with exclusive access to the government to enter into a collective bargaining agreement that has tremendous public policy implications in essentially every area of policy, from education to national security. And they're at the seat in a very special relationship, making policy decisions. And no one ever elected them. You know, they exist to serve, apparently, to serve their members' interests, not those of the general public. And that's a problem. In fact, this sort of dual fiduciary issue is a problem. You know, generally, government employees have a fiduciary duty to the taxpaying public. Union bosses, presumably, have a fiduciary duty to their members. And you really can't have both of those at the same time. And so I think that gets to some of these early people that you wouldn't think would be opponents of government labor unions like FDR or George Meany, you know, where they said you can't really have this sort of situation in the public sector, because you would then will have a situation where government union bosses can literally hold the public hostage unless their own private interests are served. And that that just shouldn't be the case. So when people think about labor unions, they should think very, very differently. For all the shortcomings of private sector labor unions and the many abuses that private sector labor unions can and have committed, they're very different from public labor unions, and they have very different public policy outcomes.
You know, let's just dive into that a little bit more, in that there's a conflict of interest that, you know, sometimes is noted, but often is more hidden beneath the surface, when you've got elected officials negotiating with individuals who are, in many cases, their largest campaign supporters. That in the private sector, you know, labor and management have a fundamental incentive to basically keep each other honest. That their interests, you know, higher wages for the workers means lower profit for the employers, and so the unions and the employers are doing what they can to do right by their members, and everyone's interests are represented. But in government, you've got, in many cases, the government officials negotiating with their largest campaign supporters. I'm reminded of former New Jersey Governor Corzine appearing at a rally with one of the state public employee unions, going up with the union president. By the way, this union is one of his major supporters in both of his races for governor, going up on the campaign podium and saying, "We're going to fight for a fair contract." What was he talking about, right? Like, who is he fighting? Like himself, right? That you've got, in essence, the unions can elect their own bosses. And when they elect politicians who are beholden to their campaign support, that they control both sides of the negotiating table. And you've got a conflict of interest in that no one is speaking for the public, for the taxpayers, for the recipients of government services. And just, if you could analyze, how do we see that playing out, in the state and local governments?
Yeah, it's particularly bad at the state and local level. You do have this sort of dangerous symbiotic relationship where public labor unions will shower elected officials at the city and state level with generous campaign contributions, and then turn around and sit down with them as an exclusive bargaining representative. And then the politicians will return the favor by showering lavish gifts on their union supporters and collective bargaining agreements. In nowhere, as you indicated, nowhere in this discussion are taxpayers represented. And I guess that raises another issue too about, unions and the tremendous, extraordinary political impact that they have. And it's usually, when we're talking about government labor unions, it's usually only on one side of the political aisle. I mean, they pour hundreds of millions of dollars into elections, generally only for one political party. 98-99% of the teachers' unions, for example, funding have gone to support the Democratic Party. And then those very same union officials that are providing these campaign contributions sit down and enter into contract negotiations, and it creates the exact problem you were talking about.
On that point, I recently saw a study that came out taking a look at just the four biggest government unions and finding that in the past two election cycles, those unions had spent a combined $700 million on politics and lobbying. They're a political juggernaut. And, in many cases, politicians who want to remain in public office feel a lot of pressure to give the unions what they want. So let's discuss some of those things they want, and one in particular, this issue of release time, or as it's known at the federal level and the federal government, official time. What exactly is release time, and why is it something that the public should care about?
Release time, generally speaking, is when a government employee is hired to perform a public function, whether it's public safety, blue-collar work, white-collar work, you name it. But rather than perform the job they were hired to perform and for which they receive taxpayer-funded salaries, they're released, in many cases, full-time to work exclusively for government labor unions. And what that means is they don't do any public function at that point. They don't report to City Hall if we're talking about the local level. They report to union headquarters. While they're on release time, they do political activities, lobbying activities. They recruit new members to the union. They file costly grievances against their government employer. They engage in union conferences, union meetings, political action committee meetings. All of this while receiving their government-funded salaries, including things like overtime and pension benefits and all of that. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary situation. I mean, think about if you had a situation where, the city of Denver or Los Angeles or New York released city workers to go work for Walmart, and Walmart gets to direct all their activities and tell them they can, be checkout clerks or greeters or whatever, but they're going to receive their city funded salaries. It's really no different than that. And in many ways, it's far, far more pernicious because of government labor unions' tremendous political power and the fact that when they sit down with their government employers, they're only always asking for more government, more intrusion into individual liberties, helps consolidate their political power base when taxpayers are offsetting some of their other costs. And
to be clear, what we have is a situation where government employees are on the clock, being paid by the taxpayers, and yet they are working for a private organization, performing business of interest to the private organization that in many cases is adversarial to the interest of the public and to the government agency that's paying their salaries.
Yep, you got it. And it's happening.
Where did this come from? I mean, this seems like totally insane.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, it exists at every level. I mean, you're more familiar with anybody about the practice at the federal level, what they call it, official time at the federal level. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about some of the things you did to address the problem of official time. But, you know, the feds spend upwards of $200 million a year on official time. It exists at the state level, and it's really particularly bad at the local level where government labor unions exercise so much political power. And, you know, here's what happens when labor unions sit down during the collective bargaining process. They're the ones doing the negotiating. Even for people who don't want to be part of the union and aren't part of the union, they get to negotiate the contract. And if you're in that seat and you're the labor boss, one thing that you might want to negotiate is a really nice carve out for yourself where you don't have to go to work for the city that hired you. Instead, you get to go work full time for the labor union, you know, whether it adversely affects all the other unit employees or all the other government employees or the public or not.
You know, I'll just give you one example from the federal government. So for the listeners who aren't aware, I served in the Trump administration on the White House Domestic Policy Council with the focus on labor policy and federal service issues. And so this issue of federal unions and release time was in sort of both areas of my portfolio, the civil service and labor policy. And some of the information we were given by the agencies about what was happening on release time was absolutely insane. The Department of Veterans Affairs, for example, pretty famously has some issues with the quality of patient care. That was a high priority for President Trump to turn around operations there. But they've had longstanding wait lists for access to care, a big scandal in the Obama administration of veterans dying for care. And one of the things they had was they had about 500 VA employees on 100% official time, including doctors and nurses and other medical personnel. Who would do nothing. They're paid as a doctor. Their job title in the agency is you know, doctor such and such, or a dentist, or a licensed practical nurse, or a registered nurse, or whatever the case may be. They're paid as a medical professional, which is pretty good salary, but they don't do any work taking care of veterans. 500 employees, many of whom are medical personnel, whose sole job is to actually make the agency less efficient by filing grievances against the agency. It's insane. And worse than that, even if the some of the union leaders wanted to do medical work, there's a situation where I was briefed on by officials at Veterans Affairs, where there was a VA clinic where it was at the height of flu season, and a number of the regular respiratory I forget the exact job title, but the people who administer the flu shots were out sick because they'd come down with the flu. So you can't have them coming in and, here's your flu vaccine. And also, by the way, we just gave you the flu, right? Like, you can't do that. So they had to be out sick, and the clinic was shorthanded. And the local union president was, in fact, trained to, or at least her job title said she was trained and qualified to do this. And so they said, hey, we've got an issue here. We're shorthanded. Could you help us? And she said, no, I can't do that. And it wasn't because she was a jerk or didn't care about veterans. For all I know, she's a perfectly fine individual. But she'd been on official time for so long that her medical competencies had expired. She hadn't seen a patient in years, and she was no longer legally allowed to perform the work for which VA was paying her to perform. So there are just some horrific abuses of this practice that make the government at the federal level just much less efficient and effective. And we spent about maybe $200 million a year, although it seems like, and this is at the federal level, $200 million a year, although the record keeping isn't that great. And my strong suspicion is that it's a lot higher, but it's at least $200 million a year. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to piggyback on the VA comment. I mean, that one hits close to home here. You probably remember a few years ago, there was a big scandal at the Phoenix VA where veterans were waiting and in some cases dying while they were waiting for care here at the Phoenix VA. And then, we did some research and we uncovered that nurses, doctors were on full-time release at the Phoenix VA while they were experiencing all these problems with veterans care. And it's extraordinary. And then, that was interesting, that example you gave about how their medical competencies had expired. We litigated a release time case against the city of Phoenix many years ago. I know we'll talk about some of the more recent litigation, but we filed a case against the city with its police union. They had six full-time police officers who were hired to perform law enforcement functions. And in some cases, some of those union officials were on full-time release for so long. In one case, it was over 15 years. They had forgotten to perform basic law enforcement functions. So when we got an injunction early on in the litigation, the police department had to send them back to the police academy to relearn basic law enforcement skills so they could actually do the job they were hired to perform.
That sounds disturbingly familiar. Yep. It was a case, maybe we'll get to it a bit later, but President Trump took a number of actions to crack down on official time abuses and just rein in these costs. And there was a case where there was a union president, longtime union president in the Social Security Administration, who had been on 100% official time. And under the new requirements, he could spend no more than a quarter of his time on official time. And he resigned and he told the reporters very publicly, I can't do my job. I haven't seen the inside of these claims processing offices and, you know, in long years. I'd have to be totally retrained. I'm not going to do that. I'm out of here, right? The notion that you have employees who are paid to do a job and whose skills have atrophied because they haven't performed this job in years or in many cases decades just strikes me as insane. And the immediate question is, like, how is any of this legal? You know, unfortunately, at the federal level, there's a law they passed that allows the unions and the agencies to bargain over this. And, you know, there's ways that that can be curtailed. But, you know, the unions get some amount of this, you know, by federal law. But, you know, states and local governments are a bit, you know, different. They're not operating under the federal collective bargaining law. And so how is any of this legal in the states?
We don't think a lot of it is. So the Goldwater Institute, where I work, has brought a number of legal challenges to the practice. One of the primary challenges, and we just litigated, in fact, just last week, a case before the Texas Supreme Court on this issue. And then the week before that, we litigated a case before the Arizona Supreme Court on this issue. We brought a challenge under the state constitution's gift clause or anti-subsidy provision. So every or virtually every state constitution has a clause in it called a gift clause or an anti-subsidy clause that prohibits using public funding for private activities. And of course, when we're talking about release time, you have publicly funding private union activities. And so we've brought various challenges representing taxpayers that assert that the whole practice of release time by transferring these public dollars to a private labor organization to use as that labor organization sees fit with no direction, control, or oversight from their city employers violates the state constitution. So both of those state high courts in Arizona and Texas just heard argument on that issue, and you know, we'll expect to see some decisions you know, in the next handful of months.
So, how do you give the listeners what was your sense of how the Texas Supreme Court justices how receptive were they to this argument, and just any sense of where you think the decision might be going or how the argument went?
I think both arguments went very well. The panels understood the issue. They in Texas and in Arizona, they seemed very keyed in to a lot of the problems that we've discussed with conflicts of interest, with these being self-interested political actors. Why are they receiving taxpayer financing? Both of these courts have shown an interest in enforcing the contours of their state constitutions in ways that protect liberty, where either the federal courts haven't or the federal courts can't because they don't have an analogous gift clause provision in the United States Constitution. So I think it went really well. There's also another sort of separate legal issue surrounding this this problem of release time. Oftentimes, when these collective bargaining agreements are negotiated, the unions will say, "Oh well, release time is just meant as just another benefit to all the government employees, whether they're union members or not." And this is just part of their whole compensation package, just like any other type of benefit, like vacation leave or sick leave or whatever, would be part of their compensation package. They try to make that argument many times to avoid a subsidy problem. The issue with that argument is that, well, okay, if release time is then just compensation like any other type of compensation, although we know it's not because it goes directly to the union. It doesn't go to individual employees. But even accepting their argument for a moment at face value, well, then we run into a compelled speech problem. Because if this is compensation to all government employees, that means that non-union members are now being forced to direct part of their compensation to union activities that they don't want to support. And that raises a compelled speech Janus problem.
So were both issues before the Supreme Court, the Texas court, compelled speech and the gift clause? And do you think you're going to reach both issues?
Both of the issues were before the Arizona Supreme Court. And the reason for that was because of a prior decision from the Arizona Supreme Court. So that court, you know, had really a decision. The one thing that was that everybody knew to be true in that case is that the union wasn't paying for release time, right? So that leaves either two options: either taxpayers are paying for it, or if you believe the city's argument, then other government employees are paying for it. In either case, it's unconstitutional. It's either unconstitutional in the gift clause, or it's unconstitutional as a free expression compelled speech problem. The Texas court just looked at the gift clause issue. The union kind of tried to raise that issue, the compensation piece, but the only one that was before the Texas Supreme Court was the gift clause.
Okay. So litigation is great insofar as it goes. It seems like, at least from what I have seen at the federal level, if you had a federal version of the gift ban, the official time would surely qualify, right? This is just a gift to the unions to subsidize their operations. And in many cases, they're using it, for things that are completely antithetical to the efficient operations of the agency, right? I mean, one of the things the unions typically get to do on release time is lobbying. So they get to go to Congress and lobby for their preferred policies, which often, times are not in the interest of effective and efficient government. Another thing that they'll do at the federal level is use it for grievances. And so you might wonder if you ever spend much time, taking a look at some of these federal grievances, you just see some like ridiculous grievances getting filed over just Mickey Mouse stuff, where the arbitrators, or in some cases, the Federal Labor Relations Authority, just laugh it out of their courtroom. There was one case I saw a few years back where you had an employee who was the union president in a minimum security federal prison in West Virginia. And you had a dress code of minimal attire that you had to wear in the prison, which makes sense that it's a law enforcement environment. And you had the union president just come in and blatantly violating the dress code and just not even wearing clothing that was, that met the code. And so the warden said, no, could you go home and change and then come back? And the union president, was somewhat talked over this and brought a grievance. And the grievance, went nowhere. And ultimately the arbitrator said, what are you smoking? You violated the policies, goodbye. But that process, like the initial stages, everything up until you bring it before an arbitrator, the arbitrators, the unions and the agencies typically split the cost 50-50. But everything up to that point, we've got these like exhaustive agency proceedings trying to resolve the grievance, is all paid for both sides of it. The taxpayers are paying for the agency side, obviously, but they're also paying for the union side. It costs them nothing. And so if you've got a union president who is torqued off at someone in an agency and just wants to tweak them or basically show that he can make their life miserable, he can file these complete Mickey Mouse grievances, and we are paying them to do it. It's absolutely insane. So, that being the case, litigation is great, especially if you win. But it's also a fairly expensive process to find plaintiffs and bring charges, and litigation's not cheap, and it's also in some ways a bit less democratic than just having the legislative body say this is a bad policy. We the people decide not to waste money on ridiculous things. Now I know that there's been some state legislative activity. I know there's also a bit of a furor right now in Utah, where a House Bill 285 got passed out of a committee that, among other things, would just completely ban all release time and require the unions to pay their own freight. And you might be shocked to know the government unions are up in arms about this and declaring that this is just the end of all that is good and true and beautiful and the worst thing since unsliced bread. But you've probably been following this more closely than I have. Where else have we been seeing action on the state level to rein in some of these fairly abusive, in my mind, subsidies?
Arizona, where the Goldwater Institute is headquartered, the legislature passed a statute here a couple years ago that prohibited release time, but just for specific political and lobbying activities. So some of the worst release time abuses. I know Washington State has introduced legislation. I don't think it got too far, but they've got problems out there, some pretty serious problems with government labor unions. A handful of other states have introduced legislation. This is also an issue for executives, governors, and in your case, James, the President Trump, to rein in some of the more egregious release time abuses. What you did and what President Trump did during your time in the White House to address this problem, is a good model for other executives who are concerned that government employees are being released, you know, from the jobs they are hired to perform to, you know, essentially advocate against the public's interest. Our listeners might be interested to hear about some of those reforms.
Yeah, no, President Trump showed very great leadership on this issue. Obviously he cares a lot about patient care and Veterans Affairs. That was a top priority for him. And in general, cares about cracking down on a lot of these wasteful practices. He came from the private sector. He was a businessman. He wanted the government to operate more efficiently. And his directives were to rein this stuff in. And one of the things he did was sign Executive Order 13837. This came out in May of 2018. And what the order did is pretty comprehensive look at the federal labor statute, which said, yes, the unions can bargain over official time, but the unions can't bargain over things that conflict with government-wide rules. And so the president said, all right, the statute says you get some, you can get some. There's certain purposes the law says we have to give it to you for, such as negotiating a contract. Fine, you get that. But why are we spending $200 million a year in this? Let's operate a lot more efficiently. And why do we have employees who can't even perform the job that they're being paid to do? And so the order said things like, look, we're not going to pay you to do official time on lobbying. No lobbying on official time. You also have to spend 75% of your duty hours doing your actual agency job. So you can spend up to a quarter of your time, which in my mind is pretty generous, doing this union business. But the other three quarters have to be on performing agency business. Other things like, we're not going to pay you to file a grievance against us. Do the grievances on your own money. It also set a target of reducing government-wide official time expenditures down to basically agency uses of official time down to the levels of the most efficient agencies. So some of the agencies like defense and state and interior were using about 1 hour of official time per employee, but government-wide the average was about 3 hours. So he said, look, when you renegotiate these bargaining agreements, bring it down to about 1 hour. We've seen that the unions operate fine in defense. They can make do with a haircut there. The unions reacted like someone had declared global thermonuclear war on the United States. I mean, they just had this apocalyptic rhetoric that this is the end of democracy. This is a direct attack on democracy. I mean, just you're getting these ridiculous subsidies. We're just trying to rein them in some so that veterans can get better care. And, the unions just had this over-the-top rhetoric. You'll be shocked to know that they raced to court. Interestingly, they filed a number of lawsuits. Some of which, one in particular, came in the Eastern District of Virginia before a Reagan appointee. The unions dropped that lawsuit. Another lawsuit came into a D.C. District Court for then-Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and that one they stuck with. She ultimately issued an injunction on the EO that then got appealed up to the appeals court, where the appeals court panel unanimously said that she had no jurisdiction to issue that order. The unions appealed to the full-on bank circuit, and not a single judge in the D.C. circuit, which, as our listeners are probably aware, is a very liberal circuit. Not a single judge in the D.C. circuit thought that Ketanji Brown Jackson had any jurisdiction. The unions then ran around to the district court in New York and got the same answer, no jurisdiction. They appealed up the Second Circuit. Again, a bipartisan panel, mostly Dem appointees, said no jurisdiction. They ran to Maryland in the Fourth Circuit and got the same answer from another district judge. So in total, 17 federal judges heard challenges to this executive order. And of those 17, the unions were smart. They were form shopping. And when they got the more conservative appointees, they dropped that lawsuit and joined a lawsuit filed by another union. So I think it was that 12 of those 17 judges were appointed by Democrat presidents. So not exactly conservative leaning judges here. And of those 17, the only single judge to believe that there was any jurisdiction to enjoin the order was Ketanji Brown Jackson. So that's a bit of the history. Eventually, as I said, the injunction was lifted and agencies were able to start implementing it. The president also found unique authority in the Department of Veterans Affairs for the Title 38 medical personnel. That's not all of their medical personnel, but you know, Congress has put some limitations on what the unions can bargain over, you know, Title 38 personnel's activities. And we realized that actually this would cover you not doing any patient business because you're on official time. And so for those Title 38 medical personnel, even while that injunction was pending, we were able to basically say, hey, look, whether getting retrained or if your competencies are active, you're going back to treat patients. But we're not allowing these long patient waiting lists. Well, you've got fully trained, you know, medical personnel not seeing patients. It's just insane. And so it will shock you to know that all those directives got rescinded within days of Biden taking office. But the authority is still there. And so a future president could easily reissue those directives.
When you were walking through that, James, it just sort of shocked me. When you think about the executive, I mean, that is the person with responsibility to control and supervise and monitor and oversee and direct government employees. And the fact that you have these labor union bosses with this tremendous amount of authority, forum shopping, going from federal court to federal court, you know, who's really in control there? And that's a real, you know, if the unions want to talk about a threat to quote unquote democracy, the fact that, you know, public employers and the executive who should have oversight authority over these government employees, in many ways doesn't, that's a true threat.
Oh, look, I agree completely. The unions have tremendous authority over agency operations. You know, once a collective bargaining agreement is entered into, the agency can't change anything in that CBA for the life of the contract. And then in almost all cases, they contain these continuance clauses. So it's not just the life of the contract, but until you negotiate a new one. And the contract supersedes presidential executive orders and, you know, government-wide regulations, you know, until it expires. And so you literally, you know, have these cases, and we've, you know, uncovered some of these conversations with the Freedom of Information Act requests, where you've got agencies like the Department of Veterans Affairs that want to do something with the working conditions that they think will benefit patient care. And you see these emails where they're basically emailing the union leaders, on official time, of course, and saying, hey, can we do this? You know, will you give us permission to do this? You know, we need a call, we need a decision, you know, on these, you know, decisions about, you know, say, promotion policies or who's going to get what assignment, right? You think that in a democracy, it's the, you know, the people and the elected, you know, representatives and, you know, ultimately the president, you know, who's making those decisions and he's accountable. What you actually see, the reality is the agency officials are saying, mother, may I, with the unions. And sometimes the answer is yes. You know, sometimes, as we've seen with these return to work directives, the answer is no. Right? That, you know, all the federal employees got to go home and work remotely during COVID. And the unions decided they rather like that. And so Biden has said, look, it's safe to go back and federal employees are going back in the office. His chief of staff thinks it's incredibly important to have federal employees back in the office because, you know, you need it to, you sort of have that, you know, sort of esprit de corps and just those water cooler conversations, that camaraderie, that, you know, sort of sense of we're together as a team, and those exchanges that will happen randomly. You can't plan for a team's call to happen, but, you know, you'll have insights and, you know, a lot of agency decisions, you know, you get inspired by things like that. And this is a top priority for the president. He's, you know, he and his chief of staff have reiterated it time and again. And the office space in Washington, D.C. is still three quarters vacant. Why? Because the federal unions, speaking for their members, don't want to go back to the office. They like working from home. I can't say I blame them. I understand that. But who gets to make that call? Is it the elected president or is it the union officers? In a democracy, the answer should be pretty clear. But the actual answer, at least as it's playing out right now, is, well, you know, you got to come to terms with the union leaders and we kind of like work from home. And so maybe we'll agree to a contract that, you know, says we only have to come into the office once a week, but we won't give you any more than that.
Right.
That's a real contract at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Their new contract says they get to work from home 8 days a week.
Extraordinary.
Eight days of pay period. You know, there's 2 weeks in a pay period. So 4 days a week on average.
Well, you know, James, I think, you know, people are just surprised that these very basic concepts of accountability, transparency, you know, not having a conflict of interest with your employer, advocating for the public interest if you're receiving a taxpayer-funded salary, is just so many areas that just doesn't exist when we're talking about government labor unions and release time is one of the worst examples of that abuse. So, you know, I'm glad that there's solutions out there. You know, there's litigation solutions, there's policy solutions, and there's executive solutions. And policymakers and others should be looking at this issue really hard to try and get back to an appropriate chain of accountability and a system that protects taxpayers and the broader public rather than the private interests of union bosses.
I totally agree. I mean, it's one thing to ask taxpayers to pay for public services that benefit the general public, or even welfare programs that are benefiting folks in need. But to take organizations that at the federal level have incomes of hundreds of millions of dollars and say, hey, guess what? We're just going to give you federal resources because we like you. And you're actually going to be impairing the operations of agencies with this money. And you're going to be making federal employees incapable of performing the jobs they're paid to do because their skills are going to fade away. But so what? Right? Like there's no public good there. There's no public benefit there. It's just a pure handout to a special interest that had the clout under Jimmy Carter to get this, this subsidy, negotiated into law as part of the price of union support for the Civil Service Reform Act. And it's long outlived its usefulness, and it needs to be reined in massively.
Yeah, exactly. Well, James, it was great talking with you. Sarah, why don't we turn it back over to you?
Absolutely. Thank you, John. And thank you, James, to both of you for sharing your time and expertise with us today. And we want to thank our listeners as well for tuning in. We will wrap it there.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.